Hey everybody, welcome to this week's abridged, shortened, and smaller version of the OIG Roundtable. It's very hard, Matt, when the Knights of the Roundtable aren't there. You can't really have an OIG Roundtable. It's really just a couple of guys sharpening pocket knives versus getting ready for gladiatorial combat.
Wade's out on a quest.
He's out on a quest, yeah.
Looking for the Holy Grail.
Yeah, he's out there looking for the 10 commandments. Wade is very embroiled in working on one of our larger CMS contracts. He's one of the team project leaders, and so it pulls him away at times. So, we have to sometimes see if we can get muddle through, as the case may be. But we're here, of course. Matt Kachansky, Senior Director here at Advise in the Payment Integrity Team, the retired Northeast UPIC Director, and the retired SAC from the OIG. And so today we're going to talk about, this was a great one. So we are going to get to, at some point, have a discussion about the big roundup that everybody's been probably reading, you know, the billions of dollars and 400 people arrested and all that. We'll get to that. There's a lot of press releases coming out outside the one that came out of Maine Justice. There have also been local U.S. attorneys kind of putting out press releases on the work that they're doing. Interesting stuff when you read it. There's a lot of stuff that's come out. CMPs were really a big portion of this, criminal cases, civil cases. We are going to talk about that. But something came across the feeds the other day, and it was kind of like when you first looked at it, you saw it was a case involving kickbacks and a lab, and you thought, all right, maybe we won't talk about it this week. Wash, rinse, repeat. But this one was interesting. A pathology lab out of Little Rock, Arkansas, was paying kickbacks to a gastroenterology group out of Pennsylvania. And so, you know, that was a little off the beaten path because it was a pathology group, gastroenterology doctors sending slides and what they call stains and samples to this lab for tests. And it went on from 2015 to 2022, which of course makes you do this because it was 7 years. And, it was kind of your typical kickback arrangement where it was a kickback paid for the work that was done. But what made this unique was that it was actual samples. It wasn't the usual genetic testing. It wasn't, you know, kind of in that space. It was a little bit different. Another piece that I thought was interesting was there was kind of an upcoding component to it. So when the samples were prepared to be sent over to the pathology lab, there was a battery of pathology tests that were deemed medically unnecessary that may not have even been connected to the gastroenterology samples that came in. And it was kind of a drop-down menu of you will always order these things. $30 million. It went on for 7 years. It's a civil case. Obviously, Matt, you and I are trying to figure out why is something like this a civil case when it sounds pretty clear. But first and foremost, we don't know a lot of the backstory. So when we read these press releases, we're pontificating just like everybody else. We scratch our head like everybody else, but we don't know the nuances. What were some of those mitigating factors on intent? What were some of those determinations that a particular U.S. attorney's office and an AUSA, assistant U.S. attorney, made as far as coming up with the conclusions to resolve this matter civilly, with or without corporate integrity agreements and things of that sort? So we got to take that aside. But Matt, this is one of those things where, again, we look at this case, it goes on for 7 years. The lab is in Pennsylvania. The provider is in the lab is in Little Rock. Provider's in Pennsylvania. They're not near each other. This doesn't appear to be a lab that's one of two or three in the country that can do this. And so you kind of got to say it's been 7 years of a fraud scheme. And why is a gastroenterology group sending work to a lab in Arkansas? And so, you know, again, the data is the data, but this is one of those where, you know, our plans working on really tight data analytics for these things. But, you know, you look at this and it's kind of there's nothing magic about the fraud scheme. Upcoding, right, by adding a routine, we'll call it upcoding, or really medically unnecessary tests, or it looks like some of the tests weren't even covered by Medicare, so there might have been a misrepresentation of it. $30 million sounds like a lot of money. It was over 7 years. So we're really talking about $4 million a year in kickbacks, which still sounds like a lot, but then you go and you divide it by 12 and that number starts to get reduced. You know, we're not negating it, but it's still, how does this stay on the radar?
And the press release doesn't say how much was billed and paid. It just, it relates just to the kickbacks that were, or the settlement. So we don't know what the actual losses were. And if you look at the tests that were done, at least the ones that are mentioned in the press release, they were sort of a two-step test. You do the first test, and then if based on the results, you do a follow-up test. In this instance, every one of them had the follow-up because it was part of the requisition just to automatically do that follow-up one. So you would think the data would show an anomaly to that, showing 100% of the time the second test is necessary when this doctor refers the specimen to this lab.
And it's pretty blatant. And this is kind of in the same vein of UDT, urine drug testing, right? When you have your qualitative quantitative, where you only do one. If one tests positive, you do the other. You don't really go through these machinations. So yeah, very, very, very similar, you know, in that vein. And, you know, when you look at an instance in which you have a, you know, in the UDT space, if you have a negative for qualification, or quantum, I forget which chicken or the egg, but when you get a negative on the one, you don't do the other, because the one test in the UDT space is a basically a yes, no. So you do your qualitative, that's what it is. Qualitative is the first, the yes or no. And then you do your quantitative. If it's a yes, what is it? It's kind of in this. They were kind of just ordering this as kind of a blanket test. Now, you know, we see this a lot in the blood lab space where the provider orders a test and it becomes a battery of tests it gets to the lab. And for those that know lab work, you know, you see instances where you get like a comprehensive metabolic panel, and it's usually a suite of tests in which there is a one reimbursement rate for that suite of tests. And in most instances, labs aren't going to do more than what the minimum number of tests are, because they're not being paid extra for that. But what you sometimes see in lab cases is they will create a panel and they'll call it, you know, executive panel one, two, whatever they want to call it. And what winds up happening is you get instances where they're either sneaking in tests that are not part of what that blanket kind of reimbursement rate is. And they're tests essentially. So, you know, years ago, I worked on a case with the, you know, with my old mentor, Jason Eisengrind, where we worked on a case involving a lab where they created a panel that had the, you know, 18 or 19 tests that were built under the particular CPT code, and then they threw in a test called amylase, which is a stomach enzyme, liver enzyme, not really very frequently ordered. It's typically ordered by endocrinologists or gastroenterologists, kind of a rare test that's ordered, and they kind of snuck it in. And the problem was that a lot of the doctors that were ordering the executive panel didn't even know that the amylase was there because they weren't looking for it. And then the problem is that doctors were getting pissed off because if you've ordered a test and the test has a negative finding, or not a negative finding, but a bad finding, you then have to act on that finding. And so doctors were getting angry because amylase is an enzyme that often has a range that is not normal, but no one really acts on it. And so all of these doctors were getting angry at the lab because it was added. But most doctors didn't complain because they didn't realize that the test was a separately billed test. And so I think that's part of it here, right? Is that, you know, but in this case, the obviously the gastroenterology group is not going to complain because they're part of the fraud, and likely this pathology lab is not doing this across all of their clients.
Right. It looks like these are specific gastro-related labs that are all over the country. So picking this particular one, so as you said, there are other ones. So picking this particular one that's, you know, 2,000 miles away or 1,500 miles away just doesn't make medical, clinical sense when they're probably other ones much closer in Western Pennsylvania to that provider.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I guess you also have to think about it from a quality of care or continuity of care. If someone is having a bunch of tests done where they need to get clinical responses to those tests, one would think that by sending stuff to a lab that is, you know, some great distance away, and it's not a super unique set of tests, there's a potential delay in continuity of care, right? I mean, you've got, you've got to package everything up. You've got to potentially dry ice it. You've got to get it shipped by a commercial carrier. It's got to get received. Those are things that take a lot longer to do than having your sample sent to a local. You know, sometimes I'm amazed when I go to a doctor and I get blood work. Sometimes I'm amazed. I feel like I just walked in the door and my test results are already in on some. Like, you know, usually within 24 hours, you get your blood tests back. So I can imagine pathology tests sometimes also take a little bit longer because it's a manual process versus an automated machine that does it. But this is one of those, Matt, payment integrity, you have to be looking at these things.
It's not a known scheme, but the numbers themselves should have jumped out at any analyst that's, you know, looking for anomalies, that, you know, the referral pattern and the 100% on the add-on claims. I was just looking at the press release. The prescriber or the ordering physician was paid a set percentage of revenue. So he got 4% of whatever Medicare and Medicaid paid.
Which is the number one rule, right, is volume-based.
Yeah.
It's volume-based.
Quid pro quo.
Right, right. So this is one of those where I think from the payment integrity side, geospacing, geofencing are important pieces of the puzzle. Now, geofencing is really, we're saying, okay, anything outside of a 50-mile radius, right, your box, we're going to really, that's going to be a problem, right? That's your geofencing. And then geospacing is looking at that. How far out are you, right? So you have to have two kind of modalities. You've got to have a geofencing and a geospacing because you have to see where are the claims coming in from and how far outside of the ring of fire should they be.
And then look to see what the alternatives are within the frame, within the fence that they could have gone to for these same services.
Right. I mean, we see this oftentimes in cases that involve pill mills with drug-seeking beneficiaries. When you've got, you know, I worked on something right before I retired where people were traveling 50, 60 miles from their address of record to an internal medicine doctor who turned out to be not even board certified in internal medicine. And 98% of his patients were getting opioids. And they were driving 50, 60 miles away, and they were all going to the same pharmacy. And it's like, you know, if that doesn't raise a 50, 60 miles for a non-board certified internal medicine doctor and 98% of his patient base are getting opioids, you know, that should raise a red flag. Yep. That should raise a red flag. What raised the red flag was that one of the patients who was a local patient overdosed, and the family found her, you know, in the basement, deceased, with boxes of fentanyl patches and oxy. And when we ran the PDP, the prescription drug program, the database that the states run, we found that she was paying for some of her prescriptions in cash and some with insurance to avoid raising that flag. But the PDMP, the prescription drug monitoring program, didn't even capture that. They didn't capture that every month she was changing it. One month she would use the fentanyl with insurance. The next month she would use the oxy with insurance. And you would see cash insurance. So it's like, you know, data sometimes is that thing, but this is, you know, payment integrity is not just staying silent on one piece. This is where, like, understanding geofencing and geolocating are and doing some of that simple vetting and doing a little Google search, Google Maps, you know, becomes part of that. And then also your basic intelligence gathering, right? Your link analysis pieces.
Right. Yeah. And this 7 years is a long time for something like this to go on without being detected. Yeah. And I'm glad it was. I'm still confused as to why it's a, you know, civil matter they have a corporate integrity agreement instead of being, you know, expelled from Medicare and Medicaid.
Right.
So maybe they're cooperating. Who knows?
Yeah, I was also surprised. I didn't say anything about a QI-TAM. There was nothing that talked about this being a relator case or the QI-TAM. So maybe at some point it was either some other piece of the puzzle. I'd love to know what that piece of the puzzle was. But typically, if this was the result of a QI-TAM, we would have seen, there'd be information about the relator bringing this forward under the QI-TAM provisions, because they always talk about that in these press releases. So it was, you know, it's an interesting case to me. Interesting case only because it went on for 7 years, and, you know, just some of the pieces of the puzzle here were a little bit different than what we normally see in these lab and kickback cases.
Hold on. The Justice Department Civil Division and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Arkansas are handling the matter. The consolidated cases, so there's a bunch of them, are captioned under U.S. XREL Watkins versus Advanced Pathology.
There we go. QI-TAM.
So, and there's a bunch of QI-TAM.
So what may have happened, all right, so there you go. So what may have actually happened was there might have been multiple relators in multiple states, and they are consolidating them and coming up with this resolution. So yeah, interesting. So there you go. Sometimes a little bit extra research. So there was a QI-TAM, and that is going to be probably, for me, that's going to be why it's taken from 2022 to 2026 to resolve, because if there are QI-TAMs that are filed in multiple districts, they will sometimes call this MDL, multi-district litigation, and it needs to be consolidated into one place. So great.
And then trying to get all the settlements and the different relators to agree to them, it's very difficult.
Right. Yeah, so there you go. That's that piece of the puzzle. It was a QI-TAM. Whenever you look at these cases and you see these kind of arrangements, the first thing you have to think of is there a QI-TAM out there that we don't know about, or has there been a resolution as to why it is a QI-TAM? I'd still love to know why there wasn't a criminal component of this as well, because you oftentimes will see with something like this, like, why isn't there, you know, why is there a not where was the non-intent piece of the puzzle? So. Interesting. Yep. Interesting. So yeah, hopefully we'll see a few more pieces of this puzzle come up as time goes on. I'm looking forward to reading some of the press releases on the takedown and seeing what came about from some of those cases, because I think there's going to be some interesting nuances to some of those cases as well, and seeing what some of those resolutions are going to be. Always remember that when you see those cases, the dollar amounts are typically billed amounts. It's typically not the paid amounts. And so when you look and you see that they're talking about $4, 5, 6 million, those are typically the billed amounts that the government believes was at risk. So we'll see where some of those resolutions come and how much money the government ultimately recovers from those cases. So there's a lot of press releases coming out. So we're going to have Wade spend a lot of time reading them.
Someone's got to.
So, yeah. All right. Listen, as always, Matt, good chat with you. Good catching up. We look forward to we've got a bunch of LinkedIn Lives that we've got coming up. And of course, the podcast every week. I think we're going to be finding some special guests that come in when Wade is not available. I think we're going to bring some of the team back together, and we're going to get the band back together for a limited tour. But as always, we appreciate everybody spending their time to engage with us on these. And we'll see you at the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.